I'm Macy Chen.
And I'm David Ball.
You're listening to CFRO, The Pulse, here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
We are your independent daily news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
And we're streaming at thepulse.coopradio.org. Good morning. It's Thursday, November 19th. Today, we chat about solutions to the overdose crisis in youth and the province's proposed Bill 22. Bill 22 would allow for the involuntary detainment of youth for up to 7 days in a medical facility after an overdose. But first, two large developments from Vancouver City Council. Vancouver is proposing to become the first Canadian city to decriminalize the possession of small amounts of illicit drugs. According to the Globe and Mail, Mayor Candy Stewart, who is forwarding the motion, says it would allow the city to fully embrace a health-focused approach to substance use. The mayor will introduce the motion on Tuesday. If approved by council, the city and Vancouver Coastal Health will submit a formal request to the federal ministers of Health and Public Safety and to Justice Minister and Attorney General David Lornetti. Under Section 56 of the Federal Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, the Minister of Health can exempt from provisions of the Act, quote, any person or class of persons, if, in the opinion of the Minister, the exemption is necessary for a medical or scientific purpose or is otherwise in the public interest, close quote. During Wednesday's press briefing, Georgia Strait reporter Charlie Smith noted that the idea to apply to the federal government for an exception against the offense of simple possession first came from Pivot Legal lawyer Caitlin Shane. In September, Pivot Legal published a report recommending Vancouver apply to the federal government for this exception. However, Shane was not acknowledged in the briefing by Mayor Stewart, who claimed to have come up with the plan. On Tuesday, members of Vancouver's council approved a comprehensive climate emergency action plan which aims to sharply reduce greenhouse gas emissions. According to the Georgia Strait, the motion directs staff to report back on how to achieve the plan's targets for complete walkable neighborhoods. Council also supported setting a target of 80% of trips being made on foot or by bike or transit by 2030 in current and emerging planning areas around rapid transit stations. In addition, council has asked staff to bring back recommendations next year aimed at eliminating off-street motor or vehicle parking requirement minimums, except for spaces required for accessibility. One of the most controversial aspects of the plan was the transport pricing portion, which would see fares levied on drivers driving into Vancouver's downtown core. Council voted to ask staff to report back before the end of 2022 after more stakeholder engagement on the transport pricing work plan. And those are our top stories for today. You're listening to The Pulse on ECFRO, we're your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy. Today, we talk about the overdose crisis in youth, and specifically Bill 22. Bill 22 was proposed by the BC NDP government earlier this year, and if implemented, would authorize the involuntary detention of youth for up to 7 days in a medical facility following an overdose. When announced earlier this year, Bill 22 met furious public opposition by many groups, including the Union of BC Indian Chiefs, the Representative for Children and Youth, the Canadian Drug Policy Coalition, and many others. The BC Coroner's Service even said the bill could potentially increase the number of fatalities in youth. I wanted to talk about Bill 22 because we're likely to see this bill resurface in the legislature. When the bill was introduced, the Greens refused to support it, and the BC NDP government said that opposition to Bill 22 was a key reason why they needed to call the snap election in October. And I bring out that bit of politics to note that we're probably going to see this bill again. In July, after the bill met such fierce public opposition, Minister of Mental Health and Addictions Judy Darcy said that the government would engage with more stakeholders and then revisit the bill. But youth advocates say that there is nothing salvageable about Bill 22. It's an important topic, and I wanted to understand what health practitioners, through research, have found out about involuntary detention in addressing substance use. Today, I chat with Karen Mitchell. Karen is an adjunct professor at the UBC School of Nursing and has worked for years with youth in Vancouver's inner city. Here's Karen. Karen Mitchell, what a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Nice to be here.
Karen, I know that over the past couple of years, you've worked a lot with youth in the inner city. Can you tell us a bit of your experience working with youth and your role there?
Yes, I'm a nurse practitioner. I work with high-risk youth who use opioids primarily, but also stimulants and other substances. And the age range is 12 to 24 years old. So my role is doing outreach and prescribing opioid agonist therapy and pharmaceutical alternatives now that we have COVID. And it's a lot of outreach. So the youth that I work with typically have a lot of concurrent issues happening at the same time. They maybe are experiencing homelessness, mental health concerns, any number of things, other physical health concerns. So there's a lot of barriers for them to access care. So we come to them, although with COVID now it's turned into half time by Zoom and half time with real people.
You said that some youth you see are as young as 12 years old. That's the
lower end of what we would see. I actually have the youngest in reality has been 14.
Okay. That's really young to be working through substance issues.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Karen, in your experience, the youth who you see, do you have a sense of why they might be turning to using substances?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question I ask everyone is, what is it that you're getting out of this? What do you like it about it? What's driving your use? And really common answers will be different kinds of pain. So it can be physical pain, emotional pain, mental pain, like anything like that. Like if you think about opioids, they're anesthetics. So why does somebody want to take an anesthetic? It's to kill pain of some sort. And they might not actually really be able to articulate that, but helping someone understand like what is driving the use can help us say like, oh, listen, this is your anxiety. It's really, really the problem. Can we treat your anxiety and then see how much you still need to use? So trying to understand each individual person's reason, but everyone has a reason. Like these drugs are difficult to take. It makes people quite sick. So there has to be something that they're needing from it that they're not getting elsewhere.
That's a really useful frame that you put out there for me about how we know that opioids are used to prescribe as painkillers in medical settings. And that's an interesting framing that it's both physical pain or it could be emotional pain or mental pain. And so, Karen, you co-wrote an article in the Taiyi just over a week ago about Bill 22, or known as the Youth Overdose Bill. Could you lay out some context for us? What is Bill 22 and why are you and your co-authors opposed to it?
Okay, yeah. So Bill 22 was introduced in, I believe it was the spring, and it was looking at a way to certify, which means hold a youth under the Mental Health Act for up to 7 days after they have an overdose. And so this is looking at youth under 19. And I think the rationale behind it is that this is a very dangerous situation. It's a young youth. We should keep them in hospital, make sure they're safe, get their treatment team together and make a treatment plan, which sounds great, but in reality, it doesn't turn out that way. So the issue, there's a lot of issues with it. One of the primary issues is that when a person's hospitalized, their tolerance to substance use drops. So when they come out of hospital, they're actually at an increased risk of a fatal overdose. So keeping a youth in hospital for 2 to 7 days has now increased their risk of overdose. Also good statistics showing that it's increasing their risk of contracting other like bloodborne illnesses like hepatitis C or HIV, anything like that, because people will be quite desperate when they come out of that. Another of the really important issues is like maintaining a relationship and engaging with these youth in healthcare. So what it looks like when someone gets admitted to hospital involuntarily is typically their clothes are taken, their phone is taken, they're told to shower, they're put in specific colored hospital pajamas, and they're their freedom of what they can do is restricted, who they can talk to is restricted. They may be given medications that they don't want to be taking. And it's a pretty traumatic experience for anyone to go through, and pretty disempowering experience for anyone to go through, but especially for like a young teen, if this is like their first introduction to healthcare, we could really be damaging their ability to trust and connect with their healthcare team over time. And so it could be doing a disservice to this youth. Another problem with it is that there isn't any plan for after that 2 to 7 days. So there are wait lists for treatment centers if a youth even would like to go to treatment. And treatment centers in British Columbia are not well regulated. So what's happening in one center doesn't necessarily mean another. They may not have medical staff. They may not support opiate agonist therapy, things like this. So this idea of pulling everything together in a week and then discharging this youth with a plan is just not realistic. We don't have that as a voluntary system. And there's just so many issues with it. The community was not consulted. Like, no youth were spoken with to get their opinions of it. Public health was not consulted. No experts in overdose prevention were consulted. Aboriginal community representatives were not consulted. So all of the key stakeholders that needed to be involved in this conversation weren't. And so the people who wrote the bill, there's no possible way they could have considered all of these factors because they don't have a background in it. And then it became quite political because, the opioid crisis is getting a lot worse since COVID. It's worse than it's ever been right now. And I think the NDP wanted to look like they're doing something to help youth who use substances. And so put this bill forward. And it does, like, if you don't know the background, it sounds like it makes sense. But when you actually take it apart, what would this look like in the real world? It's not good. And I mean, I've had circumstances where youth have maybe been started on Suboxone, which is a medication used to treat people with opioid use disorder. And Suboxone is a really great medication. It prevents overdose, but it also prevents a person from experiencing their high.
So and maybe Karen, I'll slow us down just a second here because there was so much information. I want to dig through all of that. So firstly, Bill 22, which would allow youth under 19, as you said, to be hospitalized for up to 7 days. And importantly, this is hospitalized involuntarily.
Yeah. And another issue with that is we have the Regular Mental Health Act, which would already allow for someone to be certified if they meet four particular criteria to say that they have a mental disorder and need this kind of treatment. This would mean that a youth would be able to be certified without meeting these criteria, and there are no criteria. The bill just says that it's in the best interest of that youth. But who's making that decision? And there's no appeal process. Like, none of the safeguards we have in place for people's civil rights with the Mental Health Act apply to this act or to this bill. So there's so many problems with it. And I think everyone's coming from a good place, and my colleagues that support it are coming from a good place, but I'm just very concerned that this is going to cause youth to die or to disengage from care.
There's been a huge number of criticisms about this proposed bill, and I just want to back up for a second here, and for folks who are not as familiar, who don't work in the field, as you were saying, it can sound like a good idea. Give youth the treatment that they need. And I was reading a couple of quotes from different news articles, and one woman who volunteers with Pathways to Serious Mental Illness Society, and she herself is a parent with a daughter with addiction issues, and she said, you know what, youth who are addicted, at this point, she says, quote, they can't make rational choice. And when you're suffering from addiction. And so in her opinion, this giving youth are not in a position to decide whether or not they need care. And this would be a good way to get kids the help they need. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, a few things. I would have a lot of compassion to any parent going through this with their youth because it's terrifying. But I would like to help them understand the science behind this, that there has been a lot of research that this actually increases the risk of overdose. And so that although keeping them contained sounds like it would help, there's science, very clear science, that it does not. There also isn't anything modifiable in a 7-day period. So by the end of that 7 days, the youth is going to be, like, nothing can change that quickly. And so unless there's a discharge plan for this youth to be going somewhere highly structured, that's just not, they're just coming out and now they've damaged their healthcare relationship, they've lost their tolerance, and they're still going back to the same place and situation that they were in. And I really feel for parents, they're desperate. I don't want these youth to be in distress either, I see it all the time, but we just have to engage with the reality of it as it is, not with what we think should be or what we wish was.
Right, because a lot of this too is not, as you said, not evidence-based and emotionally motivated.
Yeah.
There's so many issues with this bill, but I want to also just ask a little bit and press a little bit on this point. I've read that, I understand that 7 days is not enough to change anything. And so to play devil's advocate, what if someone said, well, instead of 7 days, make it 21 days or make it increase the threshold of days? Would that help?
No, I think that if a person needs to be certified under the Mental Health Act, we already have criteria that would state why a person would meet those criteria. And there's a system in place as part of the Mental Health Act for people to have appeals and review panels and things to have their rights protected. And anything like this that just jumps over that is putting people's rights at risk. And another thing too is this: if this is done in an urban center that's quite used to it with youth, they may handle it one way, but this is for the whole province. So what happens when a 17-year-old has an overdose in a small community and then hospitalized for a week and coming out with no OAT? It could be very dangerous. I don't think extending the time, it's the same as with adults. With people need to feel that they have autonomy over their care and their decision-making with substance use, just like with anything else. And trying to force a round peg into a square hole just doesn't work.
It makes sense to me in context of what you were saying earlier that folks use in order to numb some sort of pain. And this seems like a stopgap measure or a strong-handed measure and not addressing the root causes of why they use.
Yeah.
I'm also really curious, Karen, if you could shed some light for us. The BC Coroner Service came out with a statement and said they were strongly opposed to this.
Yeah.
And they talked about how this bill could inadvertently cause fatalities.
Yes.
How could it cause fatalities?
The most dangerous part of it is the loss of tolerance. So if somebody is held in hospital, so the tolerance is when you take a drug, you need more and more over time to get the same effect. And that means that your body's able to tolerate more in terms of not overdosing. So if somebody's using fentanyl every day and they use fentanyl again, they probably will survive it, but at the same dose. But if they haven't used it for 2 to 7 days and then they go back and they use the same amount as they had been before, that can be fatal. And especially to convey that to a teenager would be very difficult. And sometimes they may feel pressured into going on to like an opioid agonist therapy medication to get discharged from hospital. So now there's this kind of distrust with the system. They're saying one thing and wanting another. And then if they come out again, they'll stop that medication. So working with people where they're at and helping them with their goals and just sort of trying to see like how do we like what could support this person more. And looking at public health, like looking at the coroner, the BC Center on Substance Use, there's so much research showing the dangers of this. And it doesn't make sense to me that it's just not being considered the same with youth. That doesn't change on your 19th birthday.
Karen, one thing I found really interesting that really struck me as I was trying to understand this issue was the idea of cultivating a relationship of trust between youth and the healthcare system. And this would not cultivate trust. But what does that look like, Karen? Say if a youth doesn't trust the healthcare system, doesn't trust that their autonomy will be respected, what does that mean for the trajectory of a youth's life?
I think that depends on many things, but in terms of like this situation, it could be approached in different ways. So if the youth doesn't, if they want to stay in hospital and start the medication, then that's great, that can happen. If they don't, then finding out like what it is that they do want. And there's services in place, there's outreach programs that can connect, that they can connect with youth centers. There's places that they could start to engage with in a voluntary way that, maybe like a healthier option for them, because you can just say don't use drugs and not give them something else. And like you were saying too, there's legitimate reasons there's pain. I'm getting a little bit sidetracked on what your question was. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the idea of trust with the healthcare system. It made me want to add that I'm curious about is that when the BC government proposed the bill, they had a quote from the BC Children's Hospital's chief medical officer who said, you know what, this 7-day window would be a good time for you to build trust in the healthcare system because it would be a good time to build relationships with healthcare practitioners.
Yeah, that's not been my experience working with youth or adults. I've been doing this for a long time, and people experience certification as quite traumatic. Typically, they can experience it as punishing, and especially with a young person, for them to see it as anything else. I don't know how they could. Like, you're literally put into a little room, and they take your phone. Like, it's a very difficult situation to be in. They restrict who you can talk to, what you can do. You can't go for a smoke. Like, everything is restricted. So I don't think that's the best place to be building a relationship with a young person. How we do it typically in the community would be to take them for something to eat, maybe go for a walk, find out what they're interested in and see if you could do that with them. So there's other ways to build that relationship. And sometimes you have to go slow. And it's really scary because there isn't always time. Like, I think the stakes are so high right now and everyone is terrified. But we just really, really need to look at the science, and we really, really need to talk to the experts. So consultation was not done. Like, all of the different stakeholders need to be involved before anything like this could be considered at all.
Right, because many indigenous groups came out in very strong opposition to it.
Yeah. And I mean, we know there's systemic racism in our healthcare system, and we know like all of the background of that. And I mean, just putting a situation where a young person is now even at a greater risk of this and can't leave. I work with one youth who avoids hospital even when medically ill at all costs because of the situations that he's been in and the racism that he's experienced. And so that's a different situation, but this is people's experience in the real world. And so, you know, this idea of gathering the family and the friends around this youth and making a plan, not everyone has family and friends together. Not everyone has access to things. So I just think this has no criteria, and there's no no way of safeguarding civil rights. Like, this is just bad legislation, and it's very dangerous.
Karen, I'd love to tap into your experience. I'm curious what you see as short-term, medium-term, and long-term solutions.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I have the answer to that. I think each individual should be seen as an individual in the context of their life and their community and their culture, and trying to find out what they relate to. And our healthcare system in general needs a lot of work to address the racism that people do experience. In terms of working with people in the short term, for me, the primary goal is safety and build the relationship. So we have medications called opioid agonist therapy. And those are things like Suboxone, methadone, and slow-release oral morphine. So getting people to take these medications can help help them stabilize by stabilizing that physical pain, mental pain, emotional pain, stopping the withdrawal, and actually giving them some time to think through what they're doing and decide whether they want to be using and make some planning around that. And it takes time. Can be done in an inpatient or outpatient setting. It just depends. But the person absolutely has to have autonomy, and that's not age dependent. It's just what we know works with addiction is meeting people where they're at and working with them on their goals that they identify. Yeah, and getting away from the goal is abstinence for everyone. The goal is abstinence for some people, but not everyone. And these medications can be very life-saving and actually are abstinence because these are prescription medications that reduce people's the danger that people are facing from substance use. And I think that the idea with this bill would be to offer these medications to youth. But again, there's ways to offer it that work, and there's ways to offer it that don't. And an involuntary setting is not, in my opinion, a way to have somebody stay on a medication in the long term. They have to have some agency.
I'm hearing about the importance of autonomy, the importance of agency, and feeling like they have that folks have control over their individual treatments and how they go. I'm curious, Karen, as my last question, if you would have anything to add to that, if there are folks in position of policymaking power.
Yeah, I think my biggest thing that I would recommend is that they engage with all of the stakeholders. So don't take just my word for it. Get all the people in the room that are experts in public health, in overdose prevention, from various cultural groups, indigenous groups, get everyone in the room and talk about it before this can even be going forward. At this point, I think this bill needs to just be completely scrapped and then get people in the room and talk about actual solutions that would work. Most importantly, involving the youth, because they're the people that are going to be using the service.
And I hear youth are not often consulted, if at all, when it comes.
They haven't been consulted on this one, now.
Karen, thank you so much for your time today and for your work.
Yeah, thanks for covering this. Have a nice afternoon.
And that was Karen Mitchell. Karen is an adjunct professor at the UBC School of Nursing and has worked for years with youth in Vancouver's inner city. We talked about the Youth Overdose Bill, Bill 22, proposed by the BC NDP government earlier this year that would authorize the involuntary detention of youth for up to 7 days in a medical facility following an overdose. And that's it for today. You're listening to The Pulse and CFRO, your super local morning news show here on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM. I'm Tan Macy, and as always, please tell us what you think of the show. I'm at Macy at coopradio.org. That's M-E-I-X-I at coopradio.org. Ciao. Take care. And that's our program for CFRO, The Pulse.
Your independent news show, reporting on the front lines in our community.
Every weekday, 7 a.m., here on Vancouver Co-op Radio.
Find our previous podcasts and interviews at thepulse.coopradio.org.
CFRO The Pulse is brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative, a program funded by Heritage Canada and administered through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.